Radio Times, I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you've flown into or out of Terminal B at Newark Liberty International Airport, you may or may not have noticed the lighting made up of almost 200 LED fixtures. But you probably didn't know that the lights are connected to cameras and sensors that are tracking the pedestrian and vehicle traffic below. I didn't know this until I read Diane Cardwell's story in the New York Times. She writes about alternative energy for the paper's business section, and we asked her to join us on Radio Times and explain. And Diane Cardwell, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So how does the system work?
So it's a little tough to explain because I think, you know, we've all thought about light bulbs for so long as simply a light bulb that
right.
you turn on and off and it illuminates things
exactly.
for you. These are LEDs, which are semiconductors. They can have IP addresses. And so the fixture has a kind of wireless node in it that can feed or collect and transmit information. So they, through the, it's a cloud-based system. The cameras at Newark, I think there are about 8 cameras outside and inside the terminal. They feed video information digitally over the wireless network into the sensor, and then the fixture sends it to essentially a data bank where it can be analyzed for all sorts of different things.
Well, are these then specialized LEDs that have been created for this terminal?
They are indeed. The technology is from a company called Sensity, and they make, you know, sort of, they do the software for networked lights, which are, you know, have a lot of different kinds of applications and are being used in all sorts of different settings. Other companies, you know, do this stuff as well. There
right.
are, and you know, we're starting to see different cities really globally begin to test this kind of technology. It's almost, if you think of it as creating almost a kind of internet out of a network of streetlights, lights in parking lots, lights in offices, any kind of public lighting, as well as in the home.
And focusing on the airport, then who gets this information? Where is this data transmitted?
That the information is actually sitting on, you know, servers in, I think in that case, Oregon, because the company contracts with, you know, a data management services company that's elsewhere, but the information is owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and they say that they are the only agency that has access to it, and the only other way that someone else could get access to it is if they were a law enforcement agency who sent, you know, who had a subpoena because they were doing an actual investigation. You know, they're saying at least that information is just for the purposes of this particular pilot project, which is about, you know, energy efficiency and operational management, as well as boosting security.
Well, I mean, what specifically are they looking for, as you understand it?
Well, this project, like many, started with energy, right? It's like part of it is just, can we save on our electricity bills? Light bulbs burn out and, you know, it comes time to replace them. So a lot of places are looking to upgrade their lighting to, you know, more efficient, longer lasting, easier to maintain kinds of fixtures. But while they're doing that, they're also looking at the kinds of efficiencies in, say, you have a lighting system that can recognize that there's a lot of congestion on a particular line. You know, there are tons and tons of people waiting that could maybe send an alert to staff that, you know, maybe you should open up another checkout counter, or maybe we need more, you know, security screeners over at this particular gate. It can also sort of wirelessly tell you that a particular fixture is burned out or it isn't working as well. So you don't have to actually have people wandering around looking at the lights themselves, so it saves on a certain amount of labor.
Well, and I was just going to follow up on that, because so the lighting would know what security people wouldn't know, or we wouldn't need security people to tell us that there's, you know, there's a counter 12 has a really long line.
Well, you would think, but to a certain extent, the sort of the moving, I mean, we've all been through all sorts of nightmarish scenarios.
Yes, we have.
Where you stand there and think, well, maybe. But certainly all of this just rapid kind of electronic communication may end up being more efficient and helping them out. And that's really what Support Authority is looking at. But there's also, in some of these lights at Newark, there is license plate recognition technology. So that would tell you, you know, this van that, you know, maybe that would send up a flare that a van that's been stolen has just pulled up to the terminal, and maybe someone should go check that out.
Let me quickly reintroduce that's Diane Cardwell. We're talking about a story that she had recently in the New York Times about Terminal B at Newark Liberty International Airport and the LED fixtures there, not only providing light but also providing data and information sent to cameras and sensors, tracking things like pedestrians and vehicle traffic. We'd be curious about what you think of that. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Diane, is there a sign there to travelers or pedestrians, you know, walking through the through Terminal B that, you know, you are being watched by the LED lights?
You know, I actually don't know. I doubt it, but I really can't say.
I mean, on the one hand, you could say, okay, you know, another example, Big Brother trying to, you know, intrude himself in our lives. On the other hand, as you said, it could deal with things like security and crowd control and perhaps even, you know, parking management. You could see it both ways, it seems to me.
Right. And certainly, I think most people going into an airport assume that they're being watched in some way by something or someone. I think that that's just the reality of the world we live in. But certainly, because this technology is so new and is still developing, their privacy advocates have a lot of concerns because, in fact, the information is just sort of sitting there somewhere in a, you know, a computer bank waiting for app designers to figure out how it can be mined and how it can be used. You know, not all of the functionality that the companies are talking about is yet in existence. But, you know, one scenario that people talk about is this would be great for malls. And in fact, there's a company, Amerlux, that is going to be using the Sensity technology and marketing it to malls, because it's an idea that, well, someone could design an app so that when you pull into the mall, the you know, you get a note on your iPhone about where there's an empty parking space, and it might also be able to tell you that the blouse you were just shopping for online is available at Neiman Marcus.
just creeps me out, I have to tell you that.
Well, I think it creeps a lot of people out. You know, there is that fine line between, you know, convenience and intrusion.
Well, and also, I mean, I think we're getting more and more used to cameras, you know, at intersections and cameras that are watching what we do, people as well. But I guess it's the idea of lighting as surveillance or lighting as cameras. That's what sort of caught our eye in the piece that you wrote for the Times.
Right. Well, and there you know, there are different ways to do it. Some lights can have, I think, cameras actually in them. In this case, it's they're connected. But certainly in Las Vegas, where they are also piloting a system that those lights, it's street lights that can have video and audio capability. Now, Vegas officials were very, very quick to say, we're not using it for that. They're interested in the energy management and mostly in sort of broadcasting sound, so maybe announcements in a pedestrian plaza or music or what have you. But there was a lot of public opposition when those lights were first announced because the technology does exist for them to record video and audio.
You also wrote about not just the United States, but also Copenhagen has some street lamps. What's going on in Copenhagen?
Well, Copenhagen is a very, very, very green city. They take their sort of role as a leader in this seriously, and they have a kind of smart cities initiative, and those lights, they're mostly at this point interested in the energy savings, but the promise of that technology is that you could use it for traffic management, like it could sense, again, congestion, maybe we should, and kind of decide whether to go green or yellow or red, that kind of thing. But also, those lights could conceivably be connected to sensors in the trash cans that could kind of tell you when they're full, which would help, manage sanitation services as well.
Well, we were talking about the Newark Liberty International Airport run by the Port Authority. As we know, the Port Authority has been under a cloud because of, quote-unquote, Bridgegate. But is the Port Authority looking to install these LEDs, do you think, in other parts of the airport terminal, other parts of the infrastructure that they control?
Yes, there are discussions in that direction. I think they'll wait for some results out of this new system first and then decide where else to deploy it. But, if you think about an airport, they've got, airplane hangars and terminals and all sorts of things that need illumination a lot of the time. And so that's a huge part of their budget is just paying for all that lighting. Mm-hmm. And, having a system that knows that there are people in the terminal or not is, a good way for them to think about energy management. But these other functionalities, I think, are giving a lot of people some anxiety.
We're almost out of time here. But I'm curious about how you learned about this. Well, I mean, was this sort of hidden in plain sight, or it was just something you stumbled across?
I stumbled across the company's Sensity, which and its technology, and then as I dug into it, I learned more about where they were operating, and then all of the other kinds of initiatives around the world.
So this is the future, I guess.
Yes, it's here.
Well, Diane Cardwell, thank you very much for getting our conversation started.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. And she writes about alternative energy for the New York Times business section, and we called her up because of a piece she had recently in the paper having to do with the LED fixtures at the Newark Liberty International Airport at Terminal B that were more than just light. They were also connected to cameras and sensors tracking activity on the floor below and also apparently out in the parking lot. We're going to be talking more about LEDs and CFLs and lumens and Kelvin after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Widener University. Widener University offers over 60 graduate degree programs, including physical therapy, which combines classwork with hands-on learning in one of the nation's first student-led pro bono physical therapy clinics. Widener University is hosting a graduate open house on March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. That's March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. Registration is available now at widener.edu/leadership. That's widener.edu/leadership. Widener Leadership works.
Beautiful, don't you think?
Next time in Studio 360...
What?
The sunrise.
Gravity is nominated for 10 Oscars and may become the first sci-fi best picture ever. I'll talk with director-writer Alfonso Cuarón next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Yes, yes, yes.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, our resident chef Kathy Gunst has the perfect thing for winter, citrus.
Citrus is kind of this perfect food. It's low in calories, high in potassium, tons of vitamin C, we all know that.
Yep. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As of January 1st, incandescent light bulbs are no longer being made as a result of legislation passed during the Bush administration. Now, when deciding on light bulbs to buy, consumers face more choices: CFL and LED, new terminology, lumens, Kelvin, and the task of translating the old technology to the new. Well, help is on the way. Russell Leslie is a professor and associate director of the Lighting Research Center at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and joins us on Radio Times. And Russell Leslie, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on the show.
I'm glad to be back, Marty.
Nice to have you back, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for you. I'm going to give out the phone number right now at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments about light bulbs, do give us a call. You were on the show a couple of years ago when CFLs were sort of the new rage and people were beginning to talk about LEDs. Is there more, do you think, understanding and less confusion about light bulbs these days?
Well, I think there's more confusion because there are more choices and more good choices than there was at that time. One need only walk into one of the big box stores and you'll see a plethora of choices that can make even people that are well attuned to the changes in lighting make their heads spin. But it's really not all that difficult, and I'm very excited about the choices that exist now.
Well, I do want to talk about all those choices, but help us understand, because I know some people are very angry that they can't buy an incandescent light bulb. We hear about people that are hoarding the bulbs so that they'll never have to buy some of these new light bulbs. Tell us what's wrong with incandescents.
Well, the first thing is those people should relax. The law does not ban incandescent light bulbs. They just require that they're more efficient. And there are incandescent replacements that still use the incandescent technology. They're called halogen incandescent, and they have a little capsule within the bulb. And they behave pretty much like the light bulbs that we've been using for the last century, with the exception that they'll cost them less money to operate. They are not the most efficient bulb of the options, because both CFLs and LEDs will save money rather quickly, pay back any difference in the initial cost, particularly over the halogen incandescent replacements. And they offer some other benefits, especially the LED options that are available now.
I was reading about the old light bulbs, something like it was out of the energy, 10% light, 90% heat. That's what we were talking about, the old light bulbs of our childhoods, I guess.
Yeah, the incandescent bulb is like a little heater. So you're paying to convert the electricity into heat, and you, as a byproduct, you get a little bit of light. That's not bad if you're trying to heat up the room, but in most cases we heat our houses by more efficient techniques than electrical resistance heat.
Help us understand some of the terminology here. I mean, wattage measures, this, my ignorance is going to be completely on display here. So wattage measures electricity, yes?
Yeah, wattage is a measure of power, and that ultimately is what you're paying for to run your light bulb. So lower is better. it does not measure how much light you get out of the light bulb. So when we talk about a 60-watt light bulb, a 60-watt light bulb, if you had such a thing in an LED, would be extremely bright. So what you really want to look for is the other term, right, which is lumens, and that's really a measure of the amount of light. Now, light bulb packaging is now required to give you the number of lumens. For example, a 60-watt light bulb, incandescent light bulb, the ones that have been outlawed, would give you about 800 lumens. Mm. So if you wanted to replace that with an LED, you would look on the package for something to give you about 800 lumens if you wanted the same amount of light. That 800 lumens, though, could be produced for as low as about 10 watts.
Wow.
Instead of 60 watts. Now, what does that mean to the consumer? Let's suppose you had a single 60-watt incandescent light bulb, and you now can buy an LED replacement that will give you the equivalent 800 lumens for about $10. And if you operated it at, let's say, 3 hours a day, and you're paying an electric rate of about 15 cents per kilowatt hour, you would save about $8 per year, almost recapturing the price in the first year. On top of that, you would save about 43 pounds of carbon, that much, because you're using less electricity, that much less carbon would be put into the atmosphere. And over the course of the year, that incandescent bulb probably would have burnt out once, so you would not be having the hassle of getting up on a ladder and replacing it.
How long would it last? How many light hours would that last?
The LED would likely last, oh, maybe 25,000, about 25 times that of an incandescent bulb. That number is going to depend on the temperature that it operates on and the quality of the particular product that you buy.
Well, let me pick up on temperature, because there's another word that we should know, and the word is Kelvin. What does Kelvin mean?
All right. Kelvin, although it relates to the temperature, like hot or cold, when used in lighting, it really is not a measure of how hot it is to touch. Kelvin is a measure of the appearance of the light source. And a low Kelvin, let's say 2700K is what you would see on the package,
right,
indicates a warm light source. So it would have a yellowish appearance when you're looking at it, as an incandescent light bulb does, or a flame on a candle. A higher Kelvin, let's say 4,000, 5,000K, gives a cooler, whiter, or white-blue light as it gets higher and higher. Now, that's counterintuitive, because the higher the Kelvin, the cooler its appearance.
Right.
But that's the way it is as a metric. So it's a way for you to choose, do you want a cooler atmosphere from your bulb or a warmer atmosphere from your bulb? If you want the warmer, you want to choose something around 2,700 to 3,000 or 3,500K, and that's what most of us are used to in our homes in this country. In many places in Asia, the homes are used to higher Kelvin, and they would prefer, and studies show that they prefer somewhere around a 5,000K light source for the home.
And help us, and then I do want to get to our callers, help us understand then the difference between CFL and LED.
CFL is a technology that's very much like the fluorescent tubes that we're used to seeing in offices and many other places. The only difference is it takes the tubes and makes it miniature. And so it works on the principle of running a arc through a tube, energizing the gas inside, hitting phosphors that then produces light. LEDs, on the other hand, is like a computer chip. You put electricity into it, and you are able then to get light out of it. So it's a solid-state technology that's a lot easier to control.
And should we be worried about mercury levels in the CFLs?
There is mercury in any fluorescent lamp. And if it's broken, it should be cleaned up with a wet rag, and according to guidelines that the Environmental Protection Agency has on its website. However, it's a very, very small amount of mercury, and much less is put into the environment from the CFL, even if it weren't disposed of properly, than is being put in by the power plants that would have to increase the output in order to power incandescent lamps. For those listeners that are wary of having that in their home, the LED offers a wonderful alternative because it contains no mercury.
And if you do have CFL, though, what is the proper way to, I guess, dispose of it or recycle it? Or what do you do with it? If you want to be responsible, what do you do with it?
Yeah, you would. Many of the big box stores have collection points where you can bring in a used CFL. Beyond that, it would be where you would dispose of any household waste or hazardous waste, as you would for a lot of solvents or batteries.
And that's Russell Leslie, a professor and associate director of the Lighting Research Center at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and joins us in this portion of Radio Times to literally talk about how to buy a light bulb. And he's breaking down some of the information for us. And we do want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions, do give us a call. Let me see what Betty from South Philadelphia has to say. Betty, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
I am a visually impaired person, and my visually impaired friends and I would like to know what is the best lighting for a person who doesn't see well, who needs a high color rendering, not a cold color rendering.
And I'm assuming, Betty, you also want a lot of light, yes?
Yes.
Well, let me see if our guest can. Okay, let me see if our guest can help you out. Do you have any ideas for her, Russell?
Well, for people with visual impairments, there's a variety of lighting techniques, not all of which come from the light bulb. That includes contrast, improving the contrast. So, for example, if you wanted to see an edge of a stair, you would have a dark edge border against a lighter carpet. You also want to control glare, because for some visual impairments, glare can be much more painful than it is for the normally sighted person. Nonetheless, you very often require more amount of light, but it also has to be distributed so that it's even and you don't have areas of high brightness and low brightness. Betty asked about the color and color rendering. Well, the CCT metric that we talked about, Kelvin, really does not describe how well a light source will render color. It simply tells you, is it yellower or bluer? There is another metric, there are several metrics actually, but most simply is something called a color rendering index, and you want something fairly high on that metric in order to see colors better. Now, that becomes very confusing. So my tip to people that are looking to purchase light bulbs, and you want to be assured of a reasonable color rendering, not necessarily the best, but a reasonable one, would be to look for the Energy Star label on the package. Because in order to use that label, they have to meet criteria that is near the household standards for both color rendering and for the Kelvin metric.
Betty, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me pick up on something that you said, and I'm looking at an article that talks about full light distribution or 360 light all round or balanced light. And these are light bulbs that I guess distribute the light evenly. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, this is probably the first thing you want to look for when you're replacing a light bulb, is make a decision. What are you trying to do with the light bulb? And our standard light bulb in the pear-shaped configuration is designed to emit light in all directions. And this is what you want if you have it, let's say, in a table lamp, where you want some light down, some coming through the shade, some going up. The other choice is what we call a directional light, also called floodlight, spotlight, accent light. But they are they have a reflector to direct the light that's leaving the bulb in a particular direction. This is particularly good if you have it, let's say, on the outside of your house and you want it to light the ground. There's no reason to send the light up into the sky. You might as well put the light where you can use it. or in a recessed light in your ceiling where you want most of the light to come down out of the fixture onto a painting or onto the ground or your kitchen counter. If you want the directional light, you are looking for something called either a PAR, P-A-R, mm-hmm. or a BR, BR, spelled BR. And these are ones that will direct the light and make the light that you're paying for more useful by delivering it to where you need it.
Let me see what looks like Michael from Glenside has to say. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a theatrical professional, and I know that we use a lot of what we call standard theatrical lights in our industry that use incandescent, like high-wattage bulbs. The industry is going towards LEDs, but currently they just don't have the capacity and the color temperature to correctly create, you know, what we do in theater. And I'm wondering how this law might affect the purchasing of those high wattage bulbs for theatrical purposes.
Well, that's interesting, Michael. Let me see what Russell Leslie has to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're not likely to see any impact on the specialty lights at this time. The theatrical lights have a special challenge because they have to be very strong. Mm-hmm. So that means a higher wattage and, of course, a much higher lumen output than you would typically see in many home applications. LEDs over the last decade have been improving and ramping up the amount of light you can get out of a single LED lamp or light bulb. But because they are temperature sensitive, they have to be designed so that they're able to extract a lot of the heat away from the chip that is producing the light.
Hmm.
In terms of the color temperature, which was Michael's other question, we are now seeing LEDs that can have improved color property far exceeding what some many incandescent light bulbs can produce.
Well, we're about a minute away from our first break here, but it sounds like from what you're saying, Russell, Leslie, and also what other people seem to be saying, is that LED lights, that's really the future. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I believe for many, many applications, LED lights are going to be the predominant light source in the next 5 or 6 years. I think linear fluorescent lights, the ones we see in offices, will still maintain a large part of the market because that is a robust, mature technology that's very good at producing light for applications like offices and factories. We may see, even there, though, the LEDs beginning as they continue to develop and drop in price, LEDs beginning to take some of that market as well.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Yes, we are talking about how to buy a light bulb in this portion of Radio Times. And again, our guest is Russell Leslie, a professor and associate director of the Lighting Research Center. That's at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And if you have any questions about how to buy a light bulb, and I have to say I have stood in front of light bulbs in my hardware store and scratched my head trying to figure out what do I want, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet as well at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Pennsylvania Ballet, in a signature production of John Butler's Carmina Burana, March 6th through the 15th at the Academy of Music. Carmina Burana features music performed by the Pennsylvania Ballet Orchestra and the Philadelphia Singers. Also on the program, George Balanchine's Stravinsky Violin Concerto. Pennsylvania Ballet in Carmina Burana, March 6th through the 15th at the Academy of Music. Tickets at paballet.org or 215-893-1999.
Though the United States took a stance of neutrality when World War I began, the German government quickly initiated a campaign of sabotage in the U.S. that included bombings of ships and factories, an anthrax attack, and a daring attempt on the life of J.P. Morgan. Howard Blum tells the story on the next Fresh Air. His book is Dark Invasion. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A Hollywood dream come untrue?
We had 4 or 5 funerals a week. You didn't go out and party. You went home and learned how to hang IV poles.
William Wayborn, former president of the Dallas Gay Alliance, talking about the reality of the Oscar-nominated Dallas Buyers Club and why he's still rooting for the movie to win a statue. On The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Russell Leslie about how to buy a light bulb. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get back to our callers, but just a couple of quick questions for you, Russell, about LEDs. You can get them dimmable. I know that was one of the complaints about CFLs is that you couldn't dim them. Do I have that right?
Yeah, there were some, and there are some CFLs that can be dimmed, but it's much more difficult to accomplish and much less common. But LEDs, most of them are dimmable. There are still, with this evolving technology, some challenges. So one should look on the package for which dimmers they work with. Most of them will dim on pretty much any dimmer, but you might find if you have one or two together on the dimmer that one may turn on before the other, or one they may dim differentially. The better manufacturers of both the dimmers and the bulbs themselves will list or give a link to the website of what are the compatible dimmers for which bulbs. I've been buying these off the shelf and experimenting for the last year or two, and I'm finding in most cases when I buy one of the major brand light LEDs, I find that I'm having very little problem with dimming.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Steve from Allentown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello there, Marty.
Hi there.
I am calling about two things. The first is the CFLs. The way they work is by producing ultraviolet light, which energizes the phosphorus, which produces the light. If the coating of the inside of the bulb is chipped, for instance, during transportation, or if it's a cheap bulb from somewhere foreign, then we're getting exposed to significant amounts of ultraviolet light. What exactly is the level of danger of that ultraviolet light that's being put out?
Steve, let me put that to our guest. Go ahead, Russell Leslie.
Yeah, that it's a very, very small exposure. Even if the phosphor delaminated from the glass tube, the glass itself is going to reduce a large amount of ultraviolet, probably a lot less than you would get through passing in front of a window glass from the outside.
Hmm. All right, Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have we'll get to Jose in just a minute. Let me ask you about outdoor lighting. And I know that some of these technologies, I guess, respond to the cold, perhaps even the heat. What should we think about when putting lights outside of our houses?
Yeah, in LEDs love very cold. They like the cold. They don't like it where it's very hot. So a bad application of an LED would be in a warm space in an enclosed fixture where you did not have any air to help remove the heat that's produced from its heat sink. Fluorescents, they neither like very hot nor very cold. So if you're in a cold climate, like we are up here, the CFLs in your exterior fixtures are going to take a little while to come up to full light output. And if it's extremely cold, they may not even illuminate unless you have a ballast that's designed to start at very low temperatures. You won't have that problem with LEDs. The other type of outdoor lighting is something called a high-intensity discharge lamp, which are the lights that are used in street lights and other security lighting outside. And there's a number of different technologies that produce under that rubric.
In fact, we have an email question. What kind of bulb is best for motion-triggered outdoor floodlight? Do you know the answer to that question?
The problem with a motion-triggered light is it may switch on and off frequently. That's not a good application for a fluorescent light because that will affect the life of the bulb if it's switched frequently. LEDs don't care how many times you turn it on and off, and neither do incandescent. So either incandescent or LEDs would not be affected in terms of their life by frequent switching.
And does shape make a difference? I mean, we're used to those curly Q shapes, but now they're, of course, more, I would say, traditional-looking light bulbs. But does shape matter?
The shape affects the direction that light is emitted from the bulb. In most cases, for the bulbs that are putting light out in all directions, it has a fairly small difference, but purists would be able to see the difference. And if they want a true even distribution, they would favor certain shapes over others. The other impact on shape is the shape can affect the heat within the bulb, including fluorescent or LEDs. And a lot of the engineering that goes into LED bulbs is to extract more of the heat. So part of the design and the shape is to get more heat sinks and the ability to dissipate that heat.
You had mentioned earlier that, and I don't want to necessarily put name brands out on the air, but it sounds like there are different qualities of these, I guess, either LEDs or CFLs in terms of longevity. Is there a way to talk about this without promoting one brand over another?
Well, again, the Energy Star label, many manufacturers, even some brands we wouldn't recognize, that qualify for the Energy Star label, including an independent laboratory test, will be some assurance to the consumer to get a better product. The recognizable brands, I don't know if you want me to cite them or not, but they certainly put a lot of effort into protecting their brand name, and they generally also have the Energy Star label.
And what kind of, as I guess light bulb technology evolves, what are you looking for? What are you hoping for? What are you excited about?
Well, I'm excited about the fact that we will be able to more carefully tune our lighting design so that we can get more value out of the money we're putting into our lighting. For example, a lot of work done here at the Lighting Research Center is in the area of light and health. And we find that for a number of populations, from school children to the elderly to Alzheimer's patients, we can impact the quality of sleep and the circadian entrainment, which helps really regulate people's mood and a whole variety of other things. We can affect that by changing the quality of the light at different times of day, the quality and intensity. So we may want a higher Kelvin, or a bluer light in the morning at greater intensity, and then a lower or yellower night at night, which sort of mimics the 24-hour cycle that people evolved in. This is a healthy way to do lighting. LEDs, since they're solid state, will allow us to program our lighting so that it can better be attuned to human needs. So I'm very excited about how that has the potential to really change the way we do lighting in our building.
Let me take one more caller, and then we have to say goodbye to you, and we'll get our third guest in on a conversation. We have, looks like Bernie joining us on Radio Times. Bernie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm an avid radio listener, not just to WHYY's broadcast frequencies, but to shortwave radio broadcasts as well. The electronics in some of these cheap CFL bulbs seems to emit a huge amount of radio or RF interference, which when a lot of neighbors use them in a neighborhood creates a huge amount of RF background noise that can make good radio reception almost impossible on some frequencies. So I wanted to ask your guest, does he see this problem changing anytime soon, or do radio listening hobbyists like myself have to wait years for LED light bulbs to become more cost-effective than CFLs and for these noisy CFL light bulbs to just all burn out and die?
Well, Bernie, let's find out. Russell, Leslie, go ahead.
Well, I think, again, the folks that were putting, the companies that were putting their research into the CFLs and actually doing a lot of work in that area got better and better. So there is improvement on the CFLs. But I don't think you're going to have to wait too long for competitive prices on the LEDs. I'd move straight there. We see the 60-watt replacements routinely available for about $10 now. And in many states, like my own state in Vermont, it's available subsidized for $5. And that's going to pay itself back in probably a matter of months in many applications.
Bernie, thanks.
My neighbor's bulbs I care about, not mine.
I hear you. No, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Russell Leslie, thank you very much for joining us as well.
You're welcome, Marty.
And he's a professor, associate director of the Lighting Research Center at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Well, Arctic sea ice reflects the sun's heat back into space, but since the sea ice has been melting, less of that heat is being reflected and more is being absorbed by the Earth and apparently contributing to global warming. That's the conclusion of a new study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and one of the authors, Ian Eisenman, joins us to explain. He's an assistant professor at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California in San Diego. And Ian Eisenman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. And I was nervous about summarizing the findings in your study. Did I get that right?
You did.
Well, let's sort of roll back the clock a bit, if we could, and help us understand, I guess, the rate of melt for Arctic sea ice. Is that measurable? How are you measuring? How are you observing that?
It is. It's observed with satellites, and what we're observing in particular in the study is what that's doing in terms of how dark the Arctic looks. So Arctic sea ice has retreated a lot in recent decades. The summertime ice cover has diminished by about 40% during the past 35 years, according to satellite measurements.
And what we're... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and what happens, I mean, this is such sort of basic science here, once the sea ice melts, then you get more dark water, yes?
It's exactly that. So sea ice is nearly white, and it reflects most incident sunlight, and then the dark ocean that's exposed when the ice melts absorbs most incident sunlight. So it's just like how you feel hotter if you wear a black T-shirt on a sunny day than if you wear a white T-shirt. Basically, what we have here is when the sea ice retreats in the Arctic, there's a white T-shirt over the Arctic region that's been getting blacker during recent decades. And what we set out to do was to determine just how much darker the Arctic has gone as the sea ice has retreated.
And how much darker has it gone?
Well, the way this is normally quantified is in terms of something called the albedo, which basically means reflectiveness. So a perfectly white surface that reflects all the solar radiation has an albedo of 100%, and a perfectly black surface would have an albedo of 0%. And we're really interested in how reflective the Earth is when you look from space. All the sunlight that reaches the Earth is either absorbed or reflected back to space, and so if we want to know how much energy is being absorbed in the climate system, we need to know, looking from space, just how white or black the Earth looks. There's a famous photo of the Earth that was taken from space in 1972, the Blue Marble. Yeah. What we basically want to know is how much darker the Arctic would look if we took a photo like this today and compared it with the picture from the 70s. We'd have to take a lot of pictures because there's a lot of day-to-day variability. But this is what we looked into, and I should mention it's not just me. Our team was Christina Pistone, who just defended her PhD here at Scripps and was the lead author of the study, and then also Professor V. Ramanathan and myself. And what we found in terms of numbers is that during 1979 until 2011, the albedo of the Earth looking from space dropped from 52% to 48%.
Oh. Which is, I'm assuming that's a significant drop.
It doesn't sound like that much, right? Just 4%. And the reason it turns into a lot is because it turns into a lot as far as the climate is concerned is because the sun is very, very bright. There's a whole lot of light there. And if you change the reflectiveness just a little bit, it adds up to a lot of energy. In terms of putting this in terms that you can compare with other things in the climate system, first off, if you just take it and you ask how much energy it means, it's 6.4 watts per meter squared over the Arctic region. You average that. If you spread that out over the whole globe, it would turn into 0.2 watts per meter squared. Mm. In terms of meaning here, if you take... if you look at all the heating that's been caused by increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere during the same period, this is 25% as big.
Wow.
Globally.
Wow. Unfortunately,
so it's a quarter as large.
A quarter of as large. I mean, it seems like this becomes a kind of virtuous cycle, if I can say that, which is that if this is heating up the Earth, there's going to be more ice melt and therefore more exposed ocean in the Arctic and more heat. Yes?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's a very good point. So the ice albedo feedback that is a destabilizing feedback is just as you described. Warming leads to more warming. So on its own, this would cause a runaway feedback mm-hmm. loop where after something started the ice melting, there'd be nothing to stop it from all melting away. The thing is, this isn't the only process at play. There's a lot of other processes that are believed to be important in the Arctic, and some of those are actually stabilizing. So it's an important question, I think, in the field right now. What happens when you consider the interplay of all the processes at play and whether there would be a runaway feedback leading all the ice to melt away? It's actually a topic that I've worked on quite a bit in recent years. It wasn't the main topic of the study that was just published. But the results that I've found looking into this suggest there wouldn't actually be a runaway feedback, that when you consider all the processes together, it would stabilize the system. But there's still some debate
sure.
within the field.
Well, I feel like we've given you some short shrift on your research, but nonetheless, Ian Eisenman, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You're welcome. An assistant professor at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California in San Diego. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Hawes helping us out today. The program produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.